Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on harvesting rainwater when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. And Swinton just outraged all of his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now you know it, and I know it. There's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Now, the business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it, and I know it. What folly is this, toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, that's John Swinton, journalist. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this Global 2000 program, you know, this New World Order. The men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend it's time that we wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and start following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. The webpage is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email when you get there, and then send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about Harvesting Rainwater. It's a unique book. It's actually a manual is what it is. It's 8.5 by 11. Oh, shucks, got about 200 pages. I'm on page 181. Isn't quite 200. It's probably 180, 85 pages. But it's 8.5 by 11. And there's pictures, you know, for those, and diagrams to show you how to lay out your lot, how to grade it, and how to take advantage of the contours of your lot or your acre or 5 acres. I mean, you can do this with 3,000 acres, you can do it with 300 acres, you can do it with 3 acres, or you can do it with 0.3 acre. I mean, you know, whatever size piece of ground that you want to work with. In fact, it is so detailed, and it is so neat and so simple and easy. I couldn't believe the simplicity of this whole process, this whole project. 75% of the water that falls on my land runs off and then runs into the Gulf of Mexico. 75% of my water is lost to me. 25% falls on the ground, and it's absorbed into the ground, and it waters the trees and bushes and the grass, and everything's fine. 75% of it's gone. Now, I can do a few simple things, and I can save 1% here and 1% there and 1% somewhere else over there. I can direct the flow or the runoff over here, deflect it over there. I can water my trees. I can water my bushes. I can collect it in a cistern. I can pump it through my house. I can flush my toilets. I can wash my dishes. I can do all these things with the water that falls out of the sky, and I can do it on as little as 4 inches a year. Now, of course, if it rains 4 inches a year, it's a lot tougher problem than if it rains 12 inches a year or 24 inches a year or 48 inches a year. You know, the more it rains, the easier it is. Now, people out in Wichita, Kansas, no kind of out in West Kansas or Dodge City, they get about 20 to 24 inches or 25 inches a year, which is about twice as much rain as you get in Tucson, Arizona. Maybe 3 times as much rain as you get in Phoenix. So it's 2 or 3 times easier to do in Dodge City than it is in Tucson or Phoenix. But boys and girls out there in Kansas, it ain't impossible. Now, you know, you have shortages of rain out there in Kansas every once in a while. And then, you know, the normal rainfall comes back. Normal? What in the hell is normal? Take a look at the Colorado Basin as an illustration. During the 1950s, we built dams, like Glen Canyon Dam, based upon the flow of the river at that time, which was around 15 million acre feet a year. You know, just tuck that away, 15 15 million acre feet a year flowing down the Colorado River. So they said, well, let's build a couple of dams. And they did. Humongous dams. You know, Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon, those are big projects. Those are big lakes back there. And I'm not criticizing the big project. I mean, who in hell am I? But I'm pointing out to you, boys and girls, that if you want to harvest water and put it to beneficial use for the most people, the greatest number of people, then you want lots of little dams. I showed you that in the last program or two, rather than one or two great big ones. Now take a look at our great big projects. We went out and spent billions of dollars and we built Glen Canyon. We spent billions of dollars and we built Hoover Dam. Then we moved all these people into Las Vegas and all these people into Phoenix. And we took all this water. Now, watch what happens. The big project over here now is failing because the river is no longer producing 15 million acre feet. It only produces about 7, about half as much. Half. And we said, oh my God, we're in drought. Well, how in the hell did you know that the river ran 15 million acre feet over the last 400 years? We don't have records that tell us what the average is over the last 400 years. All we know is what it's been running over the last 100 years. And we've been in a wet cycle, maybe. I don't know. If it's a dry cycle, we could expect maybe it'll produce twice as much, 30 million acre feet at some point in time. But so far, it looks like it runs about 7 to 15 million acre feet. So it probably averages around 10. Meanwhile, we build these big cities around this in a wet period of time, and we're expecting 15 million acre feet, and all of a sudden we're not getting 15 million, we're only getting half as much. Meanwhile, the population has doubled. So we need twice as much water, but we're only getting half as much water. See where our dilemma is? Well, now, surely there's some big engineering company going to come along and say, well, okay, we need to solve that problem with a bigger and bigger and bigger and better project. Like one of these days, somebody's going to propose that we take the Mississippi River, dam it up, turn it so that it flows north instead of south, and then divert that water into Alberta or Saskatchewan. I don't know. Somebody somewhere is going to come up with some kind of a crazy scheme. Now, listen, when God designed this whole project over here, he gave us some rain. And he gave us enough rain to sustain life at that particular location. Let me give you an illustration. How many redwood trees do you see growing in Kansas? Think about that for a minute. How many fir trees do you see growing in Nebraska? Oh, I've driven through there a couple of times. I didn't see very many. Now, how many redwood trees do you see growing in Humboldt County, California? Quite a few. Now, the climate and the rainfall in Humboldt County, California is conducive to growing redwood trees. Now, you can grow a redwood tree in Fresno, California, or Sacramento, California. Hell, you can grow palm trees in Sacramento, California, but it ain't exactly natural or normal. So you have to accommodate that vegetation. I mean, you know, redwood trees grow. They happen to grow in Hawaii. Remember I told you that story? On Kauai, there's a little redwood forest up there about 3,000 feet where the climate just about matches Humboldt County, California, and the rainfall just about matches, and the temperature just about matches. And so in that location, somebody brought in some redwood trees and planted them. God, they're just growing like weeds. Now you try that in Dodge City, Kansas, and find out what happens. Now, conversely, how much wheat do you see growing in Humboldt County, California? You know, down around the redwood tree stumps. None, zero, zilch. And that's because the weather in Humboldt County isn't conducive to growing wheat. But there are people who live in Dodge City, Kansas, where they grow wheat, and there are people that live in Humboldt County, California, where they grow redwood trees, and everybody's living their lives. And get this, there's twice as much rain in Eureka, California, as there is in Dodge City, Kansas. But the people in Dodge City, Kansas, aren't getting ready to move out because they've only got half as much rain. They've just come to the realization they can't grow redwood trees there. So they grow wheat instead, and they live their lives, and life goes on, and everything's honky-dory. Now, you just take a look around the world, and people live in Saudi Arabia. My God, that's a bad place. Have you seen any pictures of Saudi Arabia? Hell, they haven't even got cactus growing out there. At least you got cactus in Arizona. I don't see anything growing in Saudi Arabia. Good thing they got lots of oil over there. If they didn't have oil, they'd starve to death. But you know those people over there, and I read you this report, in the Negev Desert were living out there 4,000 years ago with 4 inches of rain. Hell, they're living over there today with 4 inches of rain. All right, now there's a lesson to be learned here. You have to learn to live within the means that you have. Now, the people down in the southeast are suffering because they're used to living on 50 inches a year, but now they're only getting 25. But they can live on 25, maybe not as good. And they might not be able to grow redwood trees, but they can live there. And that's the thrust of the book called Rainwater Harvesting. It's the thrust of the book. We can make it where we're at and what we've got. So in the last program, I said, well, listen, I don't think that this is going to get any better. We got God over here telling us, you know, because you people won't pay attention to me, I'm going to withhold the rain. If you want to know where this drought in the southeast is coming from, it's coming from the creator of the universe. I know Al Gore said it's global warming, but I'm telling you, it ain't. Now, global warming is out there. You know, we saw the satellite pictures of the North Pole and the South Pole, and I see the glaciers retreating from Greenland. I'm paying attention. I'm not totally out of touch with reality. But also reported to you that the carbon dioxide emissions from Mount Pinatubo back in 94 and 95 were more. You had more carbon dioxide coming out of one volcanic eruption than all of the carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases produced by the hand of man in the last 5,000 years. So I find it hard to believe, kids, now that by burning coal, that I'm melting the glaciers in Greenland by burning electricity. Now, I don't deny that I'm throwing gasoline on the fire, but I didn't start the fire, and that fire is a lot bigger than the little bit of gas I'm throwing on it. So there's another problem that we're facing here. And this guy, God, is a big problem. I don't deny it. And he's told us, he's got a book here called the Bible. It's the scripture, but we call it the Bible. And in this book that nobody reads, and preachers don't understand, there's some statements in here where he says, hey, listen, here's what I'm going to do to you. You give me the finger, and here's what I'm going to do. And that's what we see happening. Now, New Orleans is an outgrowth of what he told. He says, I'm going to give you rain in due season. Hurricane Katrina was not rain in due season. He says, I'm going to withhold the rain from you. And that's what he's doing. He's withholding the rain out in the far west and down in the southeast. And it's really surprising because out in the west, it's pretty arid and dry anyway. So when he withholds the rain out there, it looks like it's kind of natural and normal, doesn't it? It's just another dry cycle out in California. But hey, wait a minute. You don't have droughts in Alabama. Alabama and Georgia and Florida, hell, those are southern states. They're down east of the Mississippi River. They get 50, 60 inches of rain a year. It's been that way forever. We've never seen anything like this. This is a drought that has broken all of the records. So now if we pay attention over here, this isn't really a bad drought. It's just an inconvenience so far. It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. So last time I was telling you a little story here about these humongous projects that are being built, like Grand Coulee Dam, humongous dams. But the net effect of harvesting rainwater is only about 20% of what we could have harvested had we built 100 or 1,000 little dams in that same Columbia River Basin. We could be generating greater amounts of beneficial water for millions of more people with little projects. But that doesn't lend itself to big government, big profits, and big engineering projects, from George W. Ball Company, building big dams. Now, I don't blame the big engineering companies and the big construction companies. They don't want to go out here and build some little rinky-dink dam, turning out some rinky-dink amount of electricity through hydropower to furnish power, to five or six houses or a business. They don't want that. They want something humongous, like building a dam across the Yangtze River and displacing 6 million people. That's the kind of projects those people want, where they can tax you billions of dollars and make lots of profit. But it doesn't lend itself well to solving the problem that we have. All right. So along comes a guy by the name of Lancaster. His name is Brad Lancaster. He writes a book called Rainwater Harvesting. This is the solution for George Gordon. This is the solution for Joe Sixpack. Some guy that's got an acre or 5 acres or 2 acres or 200 acres. Some guy that's a farmer. He's out here working by himself, and he finds that he's got half as much rainwater as he had in the past. What do I do now? Well, you're going to have to get by on half as much. So maybe in Alabama, where you have been growing peanuts, and you had great rainfall and you didn't have irrigation and you were growing peanuts and just living your life, and now the rainfall is half as much and you can't grow peanuts. Okay, maybe we have to grow wheat now. Maybe we have to grow corn now. Maybe we have to grow those crops that grow in areas where it rains 20 inches a year instead of 40. Have you ever thought of that? Maybe we can't grow redwood trees. Just maybe we can't grow orange trees. Maybe we can't grow what we want to grow. But, for the average Joe Sixpack that's living in his house and going to work every day, they're talking about water rationing. Well, okay. So let them ration the water. Communism is a system whereby we stand in line and share the shortage. And capitalism is the system whereby we use our labor to produce more, and then we enjoy the profit. So I'd like to have more and more, not less and less. And so when I found out that I was wasting 75% of my water, I looked around and I said, oh my God, I didn't know that until this guy pointed it out to me. That's why I suggested that you get a copy of the book. Because there are just, I'm not going to say dozens, but there are several stories in here about people, real people, guys just like you and me. Not big people that have Central California projects that just bring awe-inspiring gasps when we take a look at their dams and their projects, which I gotta concede, they're something to behold. You go down the Columbia River and you take a look at the dams across there, you're going to go, oh my God, how much cement is piled up out there? Well, that's a bunch. Generates lots of electricity. Does all these great things. But translated down here to me in Atlanta, Georgia, where the city now says I can't water my lawn, And where I'm being told, that I got to do this and do that and do something else, and they're telling me that maybe we're going to have to evacuate and maybe there isn't going to be any water coming out of my tap. That's a real problem. Now, how are you going to solve that? And here's the book. It's called Harvesting Rainwater. You can do it right there in Atlanta, Georgia, downtown Cleveland. You can do it in Birmingham, Nashville, Tennessee. I don't care where you live. In the city, out in the country, I don't care if you got 5 acres, 500 acres, 5,000 acres, or a 50 by 100 square foot lot. You can produce your own water right there and all that you need. Isn't that amazing? Just blew me away when I saw that. I looked at that and I said, my God, how can this be? And I told you about 4 inches of rain. I mean, civilizations of people living by the thousands, thousands and thousands of people living out in the desert, Negev Desert, 4,000 years ago, producing everything they need. That's equivalent to Yuma, Arizona. You people down in Yuma, Arizona, about the driest place in the country. And you can live on the 4 inches that you got. It ain't easy, but it's possible. Now, if in addition to that, you can get some Colorado River water, I'm not telling you to give up your claim to the Colorado River and all the easy water, but my point was this. There's 5 million people living down in Arizona, and you people in Arizona have 12 cubic miles of rainwater falling on your state every year, of which 75% of it is flowing into the Gulf of Lower California. I mean, your water's just draining off, and you're not utilizing it. You're utilizing 25% of it, falls on the ground, soaked up, grows cactus. And then you cry your eyeballs out, and then you go to the people in California and say, hey, send your water down here because we need it in Phoenix. Hell, you people in Phoenix have got all the water that you need right there raining down on you every year. You're just not harvesting it. You're not utilizing it. All right, now one of these days, somebody's going to tell you can't have any more Colorado River water. And then somebody says, well, it's going to cause a shortage of growth and we'll lose jobs. Well, probably, but it wouldn't if you would utilize what you've got. So get your pens and papers out here, boys and girls. Let me give you these numbers. Arizona, they call it the arid zone. And last time I was giving you some numbers. So let's see if we can get our heads wrapped around some of these numbers. So if you remember, I said an acre is about 210 by 210 feet. Now, if you've got an alley running down your block, there should be 4 houses on one side of the block and 4 houses on the other. In Eureka, California, where I'm from, 17th and 8th Street, there's 4 houses on 8th Street and 4 houses on G, and there's an alley. It runs right down the middle. It's 8 houses. That's a block. That's about 210 feet by 210 feet. That's approximately 1 acre. If it had 1 foot of water, 12 inches of water over that piece of real estate, you'd have 1 acre foot. In a year, in Eureka, California, where it rains 37 inches a year, you would have 3 feet of water on that one block. Now, I lived at 1724 8th Street when I was a kid. Now, let's think about this for a minute, because here's a block, has 3 feet of water falling on it. And they bring the water in from the Mad River up at Swayze Dam down to Eureka. You know, it's 10, 15 miles, and they're piping it down there and pumping it down there. Now, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that I needed to live, for some reason, on this one block. Well, the 8 people on that one block have 3 acre feet of water. That's 326,000. Remember, an acre foot of water is 326,000 gallons. All right, so you're living in Eureka, California. You got 326,000 gallons of water times 3 divided by 8 equals 122,000 gallons of water. That's for each house on the block between 17th Street and Wabash and G and H. 8 houses have 122,000 gallons of water per house raining down every year. Let's divide it by 2. That's 61,000. You could cut your rainfall in Eureka, California in half, and you'd have a drought, and you'd have as much water as you need to run that household just like y'all say, 61,000 gallons. Now, today you're using about 80, so you're going to have to use a little bit of conservation. You can do that yourself. All right, now, you know, you're living in Dodge City, Kansas, and you say, well, shucks, you know, all right, well, in 1950, we used to use 3,500 gallons or about 40,000 a year, so you cut back to the same level that you were back in 1950. We weren't short water in 1950. I had plenty of water to drink, plenty of water for everything we needed, and we just didn't use it as prolifically as we do today. I mentioned this the other day. I said, you know, as long as there's electricity, I'm going to flip the switch and enjoy it. Then I ain't turning the lights off until the price gets to a point where it gets my attention. But it's coming. And one of these days, they're going to get my attention. And when they do, I'm going to put in more solar panels. Now, over in Germany, remember I pointed this out to you a couple days ago. The German government and the people of Germany are trying to wean themselves off of Arab oil. They don't have oil over in Germany, and they don't have a lot of coal, and they can't make all of their electricity, so they, in France, for instance, they turn to nuclear power plants. Now, in Germany, they took a look at this, and they said, let's put solar panels on everybody's house in Germany and make that house electrically independent of the grid. Now, they hook up to the grid, and they use the grid like a battery pack. And so the sun shines, and when the sun shines, they're making electricity. And then when they're at work and they're not using electricity, that electricity is going into the grid, and their meter, their electric meter, runs backwards. And then when it's overcast or when they come home and it's nighttime and they turn on the power, they're drawing electric power out of the grid You know, it works both ways. By doing that, they burn less oil, they burn less coal, they don't need the grid cranked up, burning fossil fuels at the rate that that we do here in this country, for instance, and so they're generating a lot of solar power. Or you can put in a battery bank and you can cut yourself off from the grid like I did here. But the moral to the story is they're looking to become 100% energy independent in Germany by using solar power on their houses. So down in California, they put that to the test. God, it's working like a shot. In all those houses, they're building new houses, put solar panels on the roof. The house is energy independent. They're hooked up to the grid. When they need power, they suck it off of PG&E. When they don't need power, they sell it to PG&E. Now, there's a solution to this problem. But you see, you're never going to have that solution as long as there's ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, because those corporations have lobbyists in Washington. And the political policies that come out of Washington, come out of your state legislature, are going to be for bigger and bigger power plants, bigger and bigger dams, bigger and bigger water projects that produce the very problems that you're trying to solve. You see, boys and girls, you got bigger and bigger dams, bigger and bigger reservoirs that have half as much water in them. So they don't solve your problem. But down here at the individual level, down here at the house, the home level, we can solve our own problem. I don't need FEMA. I don't need the water company. I don't need George W. Ball. I don't need Barack Obama to solve my problems. I can solve my own problems myself for less money and live better in the process. And that's what I'm going to do. Hey, I got to give you a mid-course reminder here that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse are going to recommend and endorse us. Most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be political, religious, economic or sectarian, they could be racial, they could be ethnic partisans, whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed now by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions now of our advertiser or the sponsors or management or the staff of this network or this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, in the book that we're reviewing here called Rainwater Harvesting, there are 8 principles that they give us for harvesting rainwater. But I'm going to start here with Chapter 1, and I'm going to tell you a story here about a man who farms water and the rainwater harvesting guidelines. This guy is from Botswanaland, South Africa. He lives in an arid piece of real estate that produces about 12 to 20 inches of rain a year. It varies, just like it does in Dodge City, Kansas, or any place else. You know, some years you get more rain, some years you get less. But this is a fairly arid piece of real estate. It's kind of like the High Plains of the United States. And the people who live here are just dirt poor. Just dirt poor. Just barely able to get by. They've got little acreages, you know, 5 acres, 10 acres maybe. And they're out here growing a little corn. They're trying to grow a little this, grow a little that. They're carrying water from the water hole or from the creek or something like that. They're just dirt scrabble poor people. And there's a guy here who has a little oasis in the middle of all of this poverty. He's got this little Garden of Eden, about 7 acres in size, where he has put into practice these 8 principles of water harvesting. And, of course, all of his neighbors around him, you know, they look at this guy over here. They don't copy what he's doing. They don't emulate what he's doing. He's been doing it for 30 years. They don't go over and ask him, how do you get this, or how do you do this? Now, I told you this story the other day. I gave you the first story. It was about a guy down in Arizona. And they're out here on one of these crummy lots, out in one of these crummy old subdivisions in southwestern Arizona. He produces his own solar power, produces his own rainwater, 14 inches a year, lives nicely. He has all the water he needs. His neighbors are trucking it in. They got to haul it in with their pickups. Costs a lot of money. They got no utilities, got no wells, got no electric power. This guy's got electric power. He's got all the water he wants, living his life, doing his thing. And then they don't come over, knock on his door and ask either. Isn't that kind of bizarre? So, you know, most people are not going to do this. I'm not sitting here, you know, preaching to the choir for no good reason. I'm sitting here telling you that there's a solution to the problem. If you want the solution, here it is. If you don't want the solution, you know, go with Al Gore. Al Gore says your problems are caused by you, and you're warming the atmosphere, and what you got to do is live on less. You got to get used to taking a cut in your standard of living. And I say, Al Gore, go to hell. I don't have to take a cut in my standard of living. I need to think smarter, work smarter, and produce more for myself. And let all the rest of you people stand in line and share the shortage like all communists do. Now, if we use our heads in Atlanta, Georgia, we can have water. And if you want to rely upon your city government and FEMA, you can stand in line and share the shortage like everybody else does. But here's a guy in Botswana says, okay, I got 20 inches of rain a year in a good year. And I got 12 inches a year in a bad year. What can I do with what I've got? Not with what I wish I had, not with what other people have in other regions that I'm really jealous over, but what do I have right here at hand for me to use that can increase or produce my standard of living? And so this is the man who farms rainwater. While traveling through southern Africa in the summer of 1995, I heard of a man who was farming water, and I set out to find him. And I was soon packed into a colorful old bus roaring through the countryside of southern Zimbabwe. The scenery was beautiful, with rolling hills of yellow grass on red earth and small thickets of twisting umbrella-like trees. 9 hours later, 9 hours, running down a dirt road, we arrived in Zimbabwe's driest region. We crested a pass of low-lying semi-desert vegetation. Below us spread a vast veldt prairie of undulating hills covered with dry grass and capped with barren outcroppings of granite. Trees were sparse. All was covered by a wonderful expanse of clear blue sky, reminding me of the open grasslands of southeastern Arizona. The bus crept down and stopped in a town that I cannot pronounce, the small rural town where the water farmer lived. So in the morning, I hitched a ride with the local director of CARE International. She took me to a low row of single-story houses. One of these was the simple office of the town that I cannot pronounce, Water Resources Project, where on the porch sat the water farmer reading a Bible. Oh, for crying out loud. Now we got a religious kook. This water farmer reads the Bible. Hey, that counts out about half the people in the country, doesn't it? All right, now we got this Bible-reading water farmer who lives in a piece of real estate, or on a piece of real estate, that is similar to southeastern Arizona. I don't know what it rains in southeastern Arizona, but a little later on in the story, they'll tell us here it's going to rain about 12 to 20 inches a year. Now, as my ride came to a stop, he sprung up with a huge smile and warm greetings. Here at last was Mr. We'll call him Mr. Ferry, P-H-I-R-I. He's got some more letters in his name, but I'm going to call him Mr. Ferry. When he learned how far I had traveled, he burst into a wonderful laugh, and he told me that lately visitors from all over the world seemed to be dropping in on him about once a week. Nonetheless, for him, each was an unexpected surprise, and Mr. Ferry jumped into the vehicle, and we drove off over the worn, eroded dirt roads toward his farm. An endless stream of poetic analogies, laughter, and stories began to pour from his mouth. The best story of his own, or the best story of all, was his own story. He said that in 1965, he was fired from his job on the railway for being politically active against the white minority, Rhodesian government. The government told him that he would never work again, having to support a family of eight now. Mr. Ferry turned to the only two things that he had left. It was an overgrazed and eroding 7.4-acre family landholding and his Bible. He used the Bible as a gardening manual, and it inspired his future. Reading Genesis, he saw that everything that Adam and Eve needed was provided by the Garden of Eden. So, thought Mr. Ferry, I must create my own Garden of Eden. Yet he also realized that Adam and Eve had the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in their region, while they didn't have even an ethereal creek. So he thought, I must also create my own rivers. I must create my own ponds, my own creeks. And he and his family have done both. Now, the family farm is on the northeast facing slope of a hill providing good winter sun on the site since it is in the southern hemisphere. The top of the hill is a large exposed granite dome from which storm water runoff once freely and erosively flowed. The average annual rainfall is just over 22 inches. However, as Mr. Feary points out, this average is based on extremes. Many years are drought years when the land is lucky to receive 12 inches. When Mr. Feary began, it was very difficult to grow crops successfully, let alone make a profit. There were frequent droughts, and he had no money for deep wells, pumps, fuel, and other equipment needed for irrigating with groundwater. Along with everyone else in the area, Mr. Feary was dependent upon the rains for water. Storms always brought him outside to observe how the water flowed across his land. He noticed that soil moisture would linger longer in small depressions and upslope of rocks and plants than in the areas where shear flow went unchecked. He realized that he could mimic and he could enhance areas of his land where this was occurring, so that's what he did. He then spent ample time watching the effects of his work. Thus began his self-education in 1964 and work in rainwater harvesting, his water farming, over the next 30 years. He has created a sustainable system that now provides all of his water needs from rainfall alone. Now, you start the catchment upstream and you heal the young before the old deep gullies downstream, says Mr. Feary. Beginning at the top of the watershed, he built unmortared stone walls at random. He put them at random intervals on contour lines of equal elevation. These lines of rocks check the dam walls and slower check the water flow from the storm runoff, and then they disperse the water as it moves through the winding paths between the stones. The runoff is then more easily managed because it never gets a chance to build up to a more destructive volume and velocity. Controlled runoff from the granite dome is then directed to the unlined reservoirs just below. These small reservoirs were built with nothing more than hand tools and sweat of Mr. Feary and his family. All of the work on the 7 acres of land was and is done on the human scale so that it can be maintained on the human scale. No tractors, no animals, no horses. It's all done with muscle power. Now, the larger of the two reservoirs that Mr. Feary calls his immigration center, it is here that I welcome the water onto my farm, and then I direct the water by gravity to where it will live in the soil, he laughs. The water is directed into the soil as quickly as possible. The reservoirs are located at the highest point in the landscape, where the soil begins to cover the granite bedrock. Above the reservoirs, the slope is steep with little soil. At and below the reservoir, the slope is gentle and the soil has accumulated. The soil, Mr. Feary explains, is like a tin. The tin should hold all of the water. Gullies and erosion are like holes in the tin that allow water and organic matter to escape. These must be plugged. Let me pause here for a moment and make an observation. Here's a guy with 7 acres of ground. Now remember, I've talked to you in the past about how to make $100,000 a year off of 25 acres or less. Here's a guy that's putting that principle into practice. Now, I don't know how much this guy makes. I doubt if he's making $100,000 a year living over there in Zimbabwe, but he's living better than all of his neighbors around him. They've got some pictures here in the manual of his little farm. 7 acres isn't much of a piece of ground. I'm just looking out my window here. I've got little 2 and 3 acres fields. I look down here at 3 fields. 2, 4, 6, 1 field of 3. Just my first 3 fields up here on the top end of the ridge are as big as his little place. And yet, the contours of my 3 fields are about the same as this guy's place. Hilly, stony, outcrop, rock, really poor land. I live on a piece of really poor land. And now I see what this guy does. Now listen, this guy's doing it on 20 inches of rain a year. 20. Hell, I got double that. I got 40 inches. If this guy can turn this into a Garden of Eden on 20, surely I can do it here. You bet. I can do it. He did it. What I need to do is to learn how did this guy do that. Now, in law, I tell my students very plainly, I say, listen, you want to be a winner? You do what the winners do. What you do is you go out here and you talk to some guy that went into court and did a case. How did it come out? I won. How did you win? What did you do? He'll tell you. And when he tells you and you find out, like Yoder versus Wisconsin, want to keep your kid at home? Want to take your kid out of the public school? Hey, you want to educate him at home like the Amish do? And keep social lady and the truant officer out of your business? Then you want to go to Yoder versus Wisconsin, follow what the Amish do. If it works for them, it'll probably work for you. So I just applied the same principle here. I said, hey, listen, here's a guy making $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. Remember I told you about the Whatley program? And I got to give credit to Mr. Whatley. It was an ingenious idea. It was an ingenious program. Unfortunately, it doesn't follow biblical law. It doesn't follow the agricultural laws of the Bible. It doesn't follow the economic laws of the Bible. Mr. Whatley has licenses and permits, pays income tax, uses chemical fertilizers, and doesn't practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have a good idea. Can we improve upon his plan? Improve upon his plan. Can we do that scripturally? The answer is certainly. And that's what this guy's doing. Remember at the very first paragraph, this guy learned to do this from the Bible. This little black guy down here in Zimbabwe, I said it was Botswanaland. That's another story. There's another guy in here from Botswanaland. This guy, Fury, is in southern Rhodesia. He's got a little oasis, 7 acres, out here in a piece of real estate that looks like the desert of Arizona. And he has turned this. I mean, there is lush vegetation everywhere here. Here's a picture of his house. He's got vines. He's got grapes. He's got trees. I mean, big trees growing out here. He collects the water. He directs it. He's got ponds. And it's all done by gravity flow. This guy isn't picking up water, sticking a water pot on his head, and then walking 5 miles. You know, like you see the Africans doing, where they got all their women out there carrying water pots for 5 miles on their heads so that they have enough water to cook with. No, this guy's all automated. This thing is on autopilot. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. Gravity doesn't cost anything. He doesn't need a deep well pump. He doesn't need electricity from the power grid or from the Grand Coulee Dam to pump water so that he can irrigate his fields like we do here in the States. You know, when you're growing wheat up here in Washington State, you put a center pivot out here and you get the electric power from the Grand Coulee Dam to irrigate this piece of real estate. Well, that's expensive. And if you've got 600 horsepower and you've got plenty of money and investment capital, yeah, you can do that. This guy loses his job working for the railroad. He's got 7 acres of ground out in the desert. And he looks around and says, what am I going to do? Goes to the Bible, says, let me see if I can put these biblical principles together. And he does. He creates a Garden of Eden. This thing supports him and his family. He is the top dog. Now, in his country, in his standard of living, I would say he's probably living the lifestyle of somebody here in the United States that's making $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. And he's doing it on 7.4 acres. Now, he's been working on this thing for 30 years. It doesn't take 30 years to put something like this together. You know, if you've got a little capital, this guy's got nothing. I mean, this guy starts off, he tells his story in here, he's got nothing. He's got a couple of picks and shovels. And he goes out here, watches how the water's flowing, and he starts directing the water here and there, builds a few crude dams out of rocks, unmortared rock dams. As time progresses along, he gets more plants to grow. He sells more, makes more money, feeds his family a little better, makes a little more money. As time progresses along, he gets a little cash. Now he can put some mortar in the rocks and keep them from leaking. I mean, you talk about a poor dirt scrabble farmer, this guy's it. Now, most of us here in the United States, you know, we're not poor dirt scrabble farmers starting off. Hell, the people on welfare from this country, for crying out loud, live better than this guy does. Now, we complain a lot about our poverty. We complain a lot about our droughts. We complain a lot about government intervention, blah, blah. You know, most of what we're complaining about here in the United States, compared to what it was 20 years ago, you know, is worse today than it was 20 years ago, but it's nowhere near as bad as it is in Zimbabwe, Botswanaland, or in Saudi Arabia or Australia. Or even as bad as Tucson, Arizona, or Yuma, Arizona. In fact, I got the water, the rainfall for Yuma, Arizona here the other day. I got a chart that I'll read to you a little bit as we go along. Alaska is a desert. I didn't know that until I looked at the rainfall chart over here. The people that live in Alaska, you know, you take a look at the rainfall over here, and there's a number of places over here that get a lot of rain, like Juneau, Alaska. Average rainfall, 54 inches a year. Here's one up here, Barrow, Alaska. Barrow, you know, where the Point Barrow, Alaska, that's where all that oil is up there. Do you know how much rain they get up there? Do you know how much moisture? How much snow? It's 4.5 inches a year. Hell, that's where the Negev Desert is, for crying out loud. Barrow, Alaska, 4.5 inches a year. So there are some parts of Alaska, you know, that get 50 inches. Some of it gets 4.5, which is about like Yuma, Arizona. And I was surprised at all of the low rainfall totals, you know, 14 inches, 13 inches, 11 inches, 10 inches, 10 inches. They got some places get 36 inches and 25 inches and 54 inches. But, you know, most of the interior of Alaska is a desert. Now, it doesn't look like a desert. They don't have any cactus growing up there, but they don't have any trees either. And they got this tundra moss, or whatever they call it up there, moss the reindeer eat. And here's all these millions and millions of reindeer running around Alaska eating this moss, huge herds. And then these people up here, you know, they seem to be living pretty good on this desert up in Alaska. You know, the Eskimos and the Indians that are up there. They do the same thing over in Lapland, over in Norway, Sweden. See, these cold regions, they don't have much moisture either. And on top of that, they're cold most of the year, and you got people up there living. How do these people live up there on what they've got? And these people aren't poor. They're doing pretty good. Now, I just extrapolated that out, and I said, well, wait a minute. Now, you people down here in the South complaining about your drought down here, you know, maybe things aren't near as bad as you think they are. Now, my rainfall here dropped in half, which it hasn't yet, but it's going to. If it had dropped in half, you know, I'd be sitting here kind of struggling also. So before that happens, I think I'm going to take action. So I'm going to make some water moves on my own farm, just like this Mr. Fury did. The difference being, as I tell my students, I'm going to learn from this guy. You know, if this guy can do it down there in Zimbabwe, George Gordon can do it in Missouri. And if I can do it in Missouri, you guys can do it down in Arizona, you can do it in Alaska, you can do it in Birmingham, Alabama, or Atlanta, Georgia. Now, there's some big problems coming, and there's some big droughts coming, and there's some water shortages coming, and there's some water shortages here. And there's some problems coming. But that doesn't mean that we can't solve them. But if you're waiting for government to solve your problems, you can put your head between your knees and kiss your hind end goodbye. And if you don't think that's true, you just look at those people down on the Gulf Coast and in New Orleans. And then ask yourself, is that what you want while you're waiting for FEMA to bail your chestnuts out of the fire? If that's what you want, get in line and share the shortage. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then just go to your computer and go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Remember, adults, not children. If you'd like more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.